Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Scholarly Communication, the podcast about how knowledge gets known. I'm Daniel Shea, your host for episode 114 of the podcast. Today I'll be talking with Cormac Hurley, principal researcher at Microsoft Research. How is it that we know anything we claim to know? All right, there are easier questions out there to be asking, but the motto of this podcast is how knowledge gets known. And besides, one major research interest of my guest today most certainly warrants, at the very least, a look at this question of knowledge basis. So here goes. On what precisely do we base our knowledge claims? Or to simplify the question, how do we know? Well, let's just imagine a few scenarios here to ground this whole ethereal matter in something like real-world examples. Let us say that the thing I want to know is this. Have I locked the door behind me leaving for work? Right, that's one possible scenario, and I'll call it the locked-unlocked problem. Let me, keeping with the theme of my home, just add here quickly three further scenarios. One, when was this building I live in built? Which I'll call the when problem. Two, how was the building constructed? The how problem. And lastly, three, why was the building constructed in just this way? The why problem. Okay, so four problems about the lock, about the date of construction, about the manner of construction, and lastly, about the reason for that manner of construction. Now, it is my argument that solving any one of these problems is the path to knowledge about the matter in question. So let's just go through each of them in turn. The locked-unlocked problem is a simple one. And I can know the truth, really, just by walking back home and trying the door. Therefore, I know this because I've checked. I experience the answer directly myself, and so my knowledge, too, is direct and acquired through me. For the when problem, the matter is a little more complicated, because this building I live in stood here already before I even moved to town. Therefore, direct experience by me alone isn't going to provide the answer. However, I can just read off the cornerstone, the year 1936. Or if I'm doubtful, I can go to the municipal records office and read in the notarized documentation for the site, on the 3rd of August 1936, the building at such and such address was completed and transferred to the realtor for sale. So for the when problem, both the knowledge itself and my access to that knowledge are indirect. Nonetheless, an answer, and a pretty exact one at that, is forthcoming. In the when problem, we're still dealing with definite knowledge. The third problem I've posed, the problem of how, is more complicated still. Because although it may resemble in some ways the simpler when question, I mean, asking how is really going to entail asking such when-like questions as, which type of concrete was poured? By which method was it poured? How long did it dry, and so on. So although there is this surface similarity between the when problem and the how problem, the real snag in the how problem is that the question being asked is like an amalgamation of simpler when questions. Therefore, the knowledge of how still is definite, but the coming to know all I'll need to know, Well, that's just going to take a massive compiling of data, so that really the how problem becomes a very long list of when-type problems, all contributing their separate individual parts to the ultimate solution. And so it is that in the final analysis, there will certainly be something about the ultimate solution due to the amount of data involved which just won't be fully and satisfactorily clarified. Thus, knowledge of how is, in sum, both indirect and indefinite knowledge. Some educated guessing will be necessary in the how problem. The why problem is, though, the most complicated of the four. In fact, the questions asked for this problem are truly impossible to answer, and that's because no level of completeness in the data collection can definitively explain why. So in my example here of why the construction of my building proceeded as the construction actually did back then in the 1930s, so exactly why these materials were chosen, exactly why these materials were worked on in just the ways they were worked on, exactly why this site was chosen over other possible sites, exactly why this architectural style over other contemporary styles, in all this, no definitive explanation could be hoped for. Because although close observation, close record-keeping, close and scrutinous thinking will help provide ever greater amounts of evidence, no amount is the amount which will decide the question of why to give me absolute knowledge. Why did the construction firm bid this site to build just this building? Why did the construction workers and foremen perform the tasks they performed, and why in just that order? Really, the list here just goes on and on of the things I'd need to understand in order to explain why my building stands and why it stands in just this way. The problem here is of an order entirely different from the problems of how and of when and of locked and unlocked. Essentially, the why problem allows only indirect and indefinite knowledge, while also crucially allowing too only a particular quality of that indirect and indefinite knowledge. Basically, it's like this. With the problem of how I might feasibly arrive at a knowledge definite enough to be considered definite. However, with the problem of why, I can't and I won't, because that sort of knowledge is just not within reach. The best to be hoped for when it comes to why is a consensus with others as to what might acceptably be considered for the time being the likely or convincing explanation. Really, the thing I may know when I ask why they constructed my building the way they constructed it, that thing is only something I will know in relation to what everyone else thinks they know about it. So in support of the why knowledge I hold for true, I will certainly have to advance evidence. But more importantly, I will have to advance arguments across and through that evidence if I'm going to strike a consensus about why I have this building here to live in. And this problem of why, as well as the knowledge I might attain of it, is the most relevant knowledge for today's interview, because it's the sort of problem that scientific study faces. Why problems entail all the other three sorts, the sorts that cover direct knowing, the sorts that cover indirectly gathered information and thus indirect knowing. However, the why problem, the problem of what we call research, is really a problem that must ultimately be faced through very many acts of negotiation by the interested parties. Essentially here, a community of interested researchers needs to arrive together at increasingly convincing answers to truly unanswerable questions. This knowledge is not know or not know. This knowledge instead is a thing that improves or disimproves depending on the practice of just how that knowledge is pursued. And that is a topic I will leave to today's guest. Cormac Hurley works on data analysis and security problems. His interests include machine learning and data mining for fraud and abuse, authentication, safety, and data-driven security. So, let's begin today's episode. Right, so in my intro there, I kind of arrive at a conclusion that presents scientific knowledge as a consensus building, that there's a lot of negotiation that goes on when it comes to saying what is fact and what is not fact. And to come to your branch of science, computer science, and in particular, the subdomain of security and privacy, this itself is, I think many would agree, a relatively new area. Security and privacy itself really hit the ground running, probably most people would agree, in about the 1970s. But in any case, security and privacy would, in
I would claim, in a sense, has a fairly noticeable interdisciplinary component to it. I mean, you've got the formal sciences, you've got an engineering aspect to it for sure, you have experimental sciences working in there. So I guess what I'm driving at is that the work here is at a bit of a crossing in that way, and that's what makes one of many of your contributions, in particular a SOC at S&P Security and Privacy, the conference about the science of security, quite an important contribution. I would say that just one example that's brought up in the paper, and I would gladly hear other examples or how you would respond to that, about this clash of the formal proofs with inductive reasoning or inductive methods. But maybe you could take away that whole topic there.
Sure, and thank you for the compliment. Computer security has kind of wrestled with this. And you accurately point out there's this kind of, it's very multidisciplinary, and there has been this large disconnect between, there's a lot of formal work and very good formal work. There's been a bunch of empirical work and very good empirical work. But when you look at what drives other sciences forward, if you look at the successes in physics and biology and medicine and things like that, it doesn't, it seems that the thing that really allows you to make progress is not just good theoretical work on its own or good empirical work on its own. It's the feedback between the two. It's that you've got good theoretical work, which makes new predictions, and then experiment and empirical work goes off and either verifies or refutes those predictions and then refines theory. And you have this closed feedback loop of theory suggesting new experiments and experiments suggesting new theory. And I think it wasn't obvious when we kind of began writing that survey paper on science and security, but that in retrospect seems to be one of the things that's severely lacking, is that you have these formal communities who largely are not making use of or leaning on or informing what goes on in the empirical fields, and vice versa. The empirical stuff really isn't generating strong theory. And that seemed to me to be the missing opportunity, that sort of, people struggle with what is science, and you can spin up, conversations that go on forever on that question. And for some people, it's like, it's math and it's formula and it's people in white coats and it's doing experiments, blah, blah, blah. Well, yes, all of those things are kind of part of it. But I think the closed feedback loop between generating theory that suggests new things, suggests a view of the world, not just things that you've seen already, suggests things, how to explain things that you haven't seen yet. And then experiments that either says, yes, that theory is right, or no, not quite, or no, it's completely wrong. That's one of the things that we wanted to get to.
Yeah, this is a great way of putting it. I think this double feedback loop, this crossover between the theoretical and the empirical sides of it. I wonder then if it's not possible, and I might be pushing you beyond where you feel comfortable making claims, so please say so if it's so, but that this is one of those signs of a new science, the interdisciplinary character, which we've already mentioned, the fact that you've got the strengths of interdisciplinary work, but then you've got the sort of cooperation and communicative burden of interdisciplinary work going on as well.
And there are many things. There are many disciplines where it seems like multidisciplinary tools and skills are needed to make progress. The sort of profession of science doesn't always encourage or incent having that happen, right? In the interplay between formal people and empirical people in computer security, It's hard, you know, while many people might agree in principle that closing that feedback loop, you know, that double feedback loop would be very valuable, there doesn't seem to be a rush of participants in either of those particular two subdomains to actually make it happen. You don't see empirical people going to the theory, you know, the formal security approach conferences and vice versa. So it can be hard to make progress on some of these things purely because of maybe the incentive mechanisms and the professional pressures that, you know, multidisciplinary can often be a space that unlocks genuine new opportunity. But if it doesn't fit, you know, neatly into someone's existing publication and professional trajectory, it can easily kind of fall between the cracks.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you've got different cultures really evolving around different people's research. And I would say that, of course, that's going to make it difficult for someone to think, well, I need more of what they're doing. But this brings us probably right to the crux of what this podcast is all about, how knowledge gets known. And that is the idea that you would have perhaps two communities being able also to reach across and say, hey, look, we've got this finding of value. We've got this theory of value. We see its applications. We need your expertise. Or the best place to really run it in an empirical setting would be what you're doing over there. Does it seem to be that some of this problem really does come back to, you know, interdisciplinary cultures rather than just technical research side?
Yeah, maybe. I'm not sure. I do have a great answer on that, because there's a lot of you know human psychology and professional professor incentives and stuff like that that plays there. I mean, the languages and the tools and the skill set and the training can be very far apart in some of these communities, and in particular the empirical and the formal traditions. The empirical tradition in computer security is actually quite recent. The formal tradition is probably considerably older, and the formal tradition has, you know, emphasizes extremely rigorous mathematical tools, extremely rigorous. The empirical work, you know, ranges from usable security stuff, which borrows a lot of the kind of empirical techniques that are used in social sciences, but also there's been a lot of really good network measurement, and a lot of the people who do that empirical work would look at the tools used in the formal community, and the learning curve is extremely great. It's not an easy in. It's not just a question of culture. The gap is real and large.
Let me then turn away from culture. I very much agree with you that is a fuzzy topic and hard to get your hands around. But in the research itself, in research topics that would, let's say, fairly, according to most views, belong inside of security and privacy, which of these do really need to be bringing the empirical and the formal together? Where is it that you see in security and privacy, you know, an imminent need that we really start, increasing the formality if it's lacking, or the other side, really seeing its application and running it in experiments if that's lacking?
I mean, I think a lot of the stuff that involves the mass of consumer oriented security, right now there's, I don't know, 2-3 maybe 4 billion people using the web, using computers, using smartphones, and that have computer security needs of some kind. And one of the things that is a little difficult is that a lot of the origins of computer security work, and especially the formal stuff and some of the crypto stuff, came from a world several decades ago when computers were not used by ordinary human beings. They were, you know, big machines locked, you know, in locked buildings with people with secure access, and there were very high assurance. And some of the formal techniques and a lot of the formal approaches have sort of come from that world where everything is high assurance. You assume that arbitrary levels of effort to protect your resources are appropriate, and those tools might indeed be appropriate in certain settings. But when you transplant them to a space where 3 or 4 billion users are just trying to do their stuff, they're just trying to, you know, protect their social media accounts and their Netflix accounts and stuff like that. Well, you know, saying that you have to, you know, go through this elaborate 7-step process before you log into a website, well, you're just not going to do it if it's just a social media thing and you're just trying to post, you know, pictures and stuff like that. So I think that there's much. And a lot of sometimes a bit of the approach of the more formal and the high assurance security approaches to the uncertainties and that are introduced by this large population has been to kind of regard it as an inconvenience. I think we need a lot more measurement on protecting the consumer web on, you know, well, you might have a mental model. Like a good example is another area that I spent a bunch of time on passwords. A lot of the formal approaches to those were, well, you know, users must choose random passwords, and we observe that they don't. And then you come up with these a lot of the origin of those much hated rules around choosing passwords that must be, you know, 10 characters and contain, you know, upper, lower and special characters and digits and stuff like that. The origin of a lot of that is formal approaches saying we have to force this user population to match our model of what is necessary to protect high assurance assets. And there wasn't a lot of empirical verification that the tools and the techniques that you use to try to force your desired outcome actually achieved your desired outcome. And that's where the last few years, the last, say, decade or decade and a half, there's been enormous progress in measuring that, well, you know, you might want, you know, a billion users to do one thing, you might try to force them to do that thing, but you need to also measure that, you know, they do that thing. And if not, how you can make it easier or whether it's really necessary.
That makes a lot of sense. The idea of at the formal side inside of consumer oriented security needs to really be working inside of the consumer oriented part of that. Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. What that brings to mind also is machine learning, which is another area that you are interested in, have done important work in. And I think there's also probably an interesting set of formal and experimental sides to that as well, because of the fact that, you know, machine learning is capable of doing just massively impressive things. And yet, you know, the scientists themselves can't really say why the machine learning is doing it that way or how it's doing it even. I mean, this is for an outsider something that is just fascinating because of the basic setup that, well, we built the machine, let's say, and there it goes. It's doing something we don't even understand. Is that a similar area where you'd see the need for theory and experiment combining in a unique fashion?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. I think there, when things are very small scale, you can sort of, you know, try to study something in a phenomenon so that you understand it in and so you understand how it will behave, what the outputs will be, given any possible input. But when we get to things that are really, really complex, like the large language models, you know, GPT and things like that, which are, you know, although are making the news the last few weeks. But when something either gets very, very complicated, so no one single human being can kind of comprehend what's going on, or where the range of inputs is basically, you know, anything that's out there in the world. I mean, we need, I'm not sure we see alternatives to empirical approaches to figuring out what's going on. We could sit down with a blank sheet of paper and try to ask ourselves, what will this extremely complicated machine learning model do under this particular input or that particular input, and try to come up with some characterization of it. But another approach is to do much of the, you know, to borrow techniques that they use, for example, in biology and medicine, and you study the thing sort of as a black box phenomenon. You just throw lots of inputs at it. You see how it actually does. And there's a lot of good work to be done there, I think, a lot of good work.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you bring up biology, because one other sort of high-level topic that I certainly wanted to broach with you was, you know, scientific practice in security and privacy. And my listeners will know I work now with computer scientists, helping them communication. And I have some experience also with biologists, and I noticed that there is different practice going on there. For instance, the approach to reproducibility for biologists, it's generally a matter of, in the methods section, justifying your choices. And it's not that you expect someone's going to actually rerun your experiment. Whereas I'm noticing now in computer science departments, well, since it's really a matter of code, the experiments are often indeed recapitulated exactly. And that to me was quite interesting, because that makes for a different setup in how you you know, go about a particular study, I would say.
Absolutely. And there is some culture in the usable security, which is a heavily empirical field within computer security, of releasing data sets and, you know, allowing other people to scrutinize, you know, hey, here's what we concluded from the data and here's why, but here's the data in case, you know, you want to disagree or find errors in what we did, which is great. There is also, however, a large body of work emerging, and some of the stuff, particularly say on the consumer website, some of the data sets are so enormous that the analysis always goes to the data and not the other way around. And often with these, you know, large data sets, it's not really a static set of data. It's a stream of stuff. If you pick, you know, the stream of what's going on. Suppose, for example, you're studying something like misinformation on social media networks. Well, a snapshot of a particular event on one social media network is certainly interesting, but more interesting is kind of trying to develop algorithms that will generalize not just across this particular misinformation event, but, you know, over others. And that's primarily what, say, the practitioners who have to deploy systems that will reduce, you know, these harms have to worry about. But then you're always working on a stream, and it is logistically, it would be extremely difficult to open that up to other people. But B, you know, those streams are largely proprietary and live in. It's a little unfortunate that a lot of the a lot of the data sets where there's a lot of interest in figuring out what's going on are locked in fairly, you know, silos with fairly thick walls where there's extremely limited ability for and some research groups at some of these social media companies and other places, you know, do publish some of their work, but very often there's no real way to get access to any of the data, even in very aggregated form.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. What you say there, though, puts me in mind of, you know, if you've got this moving target of streaming data and you're analyzing misinformation across social media, as you say, I mean, it puts me in mind again back to this question that we kind of tried to avoid of cultures and human psychology, of actually situating itself a little bit at the center of what's also going on in security and privacy. I mean, just the name of the subdomain, security and privacy, it's the privacy of people and security for people. I mean, one of the sort of major constructs that's at work so often in the research is the adversary. And of course, the adversary is, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, a person, right?
Yes. I mean, or an organization, or yes.
So this puts us in the difficult position of trying to figure out what people are going to do, doesn't it? I mean, this might also explain a very typical feature of the research field, which involves so-called attack papers. And if listeners aren't aware, then this is merely just the idea that, you know, the researchers themselves find the weakness and devise a way to get in into the system or break something, essentially, and thereby prove, that work needs to be done.
Right. The adversarial nature, I mean, this is definitely one of the things that makes empirical a challenge that empirical work and empirical approaches to demonstrating that something that you can protect something is a difficulty that they don't possess in biological mechanisms, for example, where when you study a system in biology and you study you studied it in last year, well, you can kind of assume that the behavior of the system last year is representative of what it's going to continue to do going forward. In security, you know, the statistics and the properties of the attack behavior, what your attacker is doing, and it doesn't just have to be a single, you know, a single guy in a hoodie, you know, typing away at a keyboard. If you look at, say, something like that we would investigate statistically, like spam, well, you know, spam 10 years ago, spam evolves a lot over time. At some points, they were all pushing thick Rolexes, and then it was, you know, the Canadian pharmacy, you know, prescription pills without a prescription kind of stuff. And it seems to vary, which is just perhaps a long-winded way of saying that the phenomenon is not static. So you study it at one period of time, and that's not necessarily representative of what, you know, you're going to see at a later period of time. And this, you know, represents a very significant challenge, because suppose, for example, you know, you're studying misinformation, and you study a particular misinformation campaign where some organization is pushing a point of view that is, and you study the techniques that they're using and the what they did to push forward their objectives. The expectation that generalizes to future campaigns and future instances is not necessarily rock solid, right? They can't change. And that represents a very, very, very significant challenge for empirical work in this space.
Yeah, definitely, for sure. Coming back to the SOK, the systematization of knowledge, which is basically a sort of literature review for people who aren't inside of computer science. This is that science, security, and the elusive goal of security as a scientific pursuit. I'd like to switch gears and talk a bit more about the communication side. And it's an interesting fact that this paper was handed to me as an example of good writing in computer science. And I wholeheartedly agree, because I've spent quite a lot of time now reading papers in computer science, and it stands out in that respect. Could you perhaps give us your...
flattery will get you everywhere.
I am laying it on thick, but I really mean it. I mean, it was also one of those papers. Of course, the subject matter is very heavily into the area of philosophy and humanities type subjects, so that might explain why it was also very easy for me to read. But nonetheless, I think very many people would agree that it makes its point clearly and at times even elegantly. But let's focus on the clear bit. Could you perhaps give us your view of writing a paper like that? What is it that, you know, was showing you that you were achieving the aim that you had to get your purpose and your material across?
I guess maybe I would riff off of the word you just used, which was kind of, you know, clear or clarity, because clarity has kind of been, I mean, often the act of writing a paper, especially one like this, which is kind of a bit more of a review and kind of covers, you know, tries to pull together a lot of things and cover a lot of ground. Often my goal in writing some of that is getting to personal clarity on what's going on, because, you know, it wasn't the case that we started that this paper with perfect clarity in our heads on everything. The act of writing, the act of wanting to, you know, we had a sense that there's some things wrong in security, there are some missed opportunities, there are some things where security is doing things noticeably different from other domains and other disciplines, and there also seems to be some sense of I don't know, disappointment or frustration in the community and with the funding agencies that fund the community, that, hey, you know, should we be making more progress here? Could we be doing a better job? But it's one thing to have those kind of understandings that I just articulated, and another to really get them in a very crystal clear form. And a lot of the effort in that paper was, I can't remember. I guess a number of people have made this observation over the decades and the centuries. But, you know, if you can't write something down in an extremely clear, basic language, then a really good explanation for what's going on is that it's not really clear yourself. If the ideas are absolutely clear in your head, you should be able to write them down in clear and simple language. And we had, when we started, we weren't able to do that. And this whole paper, what was the act of getting to that clarity I'm gratified to hear that it's readable and clear for other people, but that was sort of an outcome of forcing ourselves to to make it clearer, to get to clarity ourselves, and to not settle every once in a while, particularly on a topic like this, where, you know, there's history, there's philosophy, it references, you know, a bunch of different sciences, a lot of the stuff in security and its subdomains, but also physics and biology. So there's a lot of ground, and it can be very tempting to find yourself relying on weasel words and ambiguous language to get around little things that you can't quite explain and you hope the reader doesn't notice. And I think we both sort of, my co-author was Paul von Oerschot, we both sort of didn't want to satisfy ourselves with that. We wanted to sort of drive out, you know, all of as much ambiguity and weasel word and hand waving stuff as we could.
Yes, weasel word. That's a wonderful way of putting it. But I mean, weasel words are often even technical terms. That's like something that I've noticed, that people, a technical term, jargon in a more derogatory sense, but I mean, technical terms are there in the science for good reason. They fill the lexicon and they're what we're researching about, right? We need a word for these things. And that's one thing. I mean, from a linguist's perspective, I can tell you one thing that science has done to the English language is enrich its vocabulary. I mean, the vocabulary is just bursting because of science. But the point is that you draw a beautiful line, which I've heard drawn also in very different contexts, between the thinking and the writing. So through the process of writing it out, that the thinking becomes more and more apparent, and you use the tool of writing to make sense of what it is that you found there, and the process iterates and iterates from there. So if that's the case, yeah, if it's possible for the language to be useful, it's also possible for useful things in the language to become unuseful. So back to the terminologies, right?
Yep, absolutely.
If you've packed up into, I mean, a weasel word is, of course, trying to just get your way out of something. But I mean, if you packed up a lot of things into certain terms and you're just rehashing them, it pays once in a while to unpack what is it actually there that I've got.
Yeah. No, and... this was something that surfaced a lot, and we tried to draw attention to in that paper. But I think it surfaces in a bunch of other places in computer sciences. You will see people arguing about a system, and they say, "Is it secure or is it not secure?" And you have people having very animated arguments on both sides of this question when it's not clear that they both mean the same thing by the word secure. And this seems like a classic example of, well, you know, if we're talking about different things and I'm saying yay and you're saying nay, well, the argument has no halting criterion. We could argue for decades or until we both, you know, get bored and go away. And I think this is one place where people within engineering and a mathematical and a STEM type training are actually more vulnerable to failing to take on board the confusion that can be caused by ambiguous language. This is something that I think, you know, people who, you know, take even one or two semesters of philosophy understand well, right? That if we're arguing about some abstract noun and we don't both have the same understanding of what that abstract noun means, well, the argument can go on and be fairly fruitless for a long period of time. I mean, another example that I think is kind of raging right now is with the success of, you know, GPT-4 and you know, these large language model things, people are arguing, you know, is it intelligent? Does it have understanding? Is it, you know, is it thinking? And, well, and some people are saying, yes, yes, we think it is. And others are saying, no, no. And, but they don't, it's not clear that there's a common understanding of what thinking means or what understanding means. So the debate seems to be one of those things that could go on for, you know, it seems one of those pointless kind of no halting criterion questions.
Yeah, I mean, you bring up a really key interest of this podcast and what you say there. I mean, the STEM sciences are not inherently language sciences. And this is probably one of the reasons why on the communication end of STEM, there are very many challenges which everyone is noticing and, you know, a lot of people are trying to do something about, but it's just not, let's say, well, it's not ideal, is it, at the moment? The way the papers come out, the way the understanding occurs or doesn't occur, and so on. And I suppose what I would like to ask there, because this is something that I explore with practically every guest I have on the show, especially people who are in the research themselves like you, what is it that would be on the education level, on the publishing level, in the research lab level, the research group level, what would be some of the interventions that you would say would not only be effective, but really be taken up? Because, I mean, just to perhaps send off one last idea before I give the stage back to you is, you know, from the linguist's perspective, from the, let's say, the EAP, English for Academic Purposes perspective, these kinds of people, which is my background, come up with all these ideas and classes and courses and materials and so on. But if you spend time with scientists, you realize that they're rushed, they have little patience for their non-science work, and it's really not a practicable solution to say, let's take a course, even in very many cases.
Yes, and yes. I would say, if I had an answer to the problem you were posing, I would give it to you. I'm not holding back, but I'm going to be unable to solve the problem. I think in addition, I think that some of the very tech heavy disciplines, and it's happening now in machine learning, I think, and people are starting to talk about this question, can machines think and stuff like that. It reminds me quite a bit of some of the stuff that happens when physics goes a little bit off the rails, right? And people start talking about the God particle and the theory of everything, and they have these kind of extravagant metaphors and language that seems very far removed from the, you know, from the Newton's laws and Einstein, you know, and the calculation side of things. And I think there's a danger when you come from a super successful technical area like physics and mathematics and machine learning that has delivered, you know, has accomplished amazingly, you know, great things, people, and then it starts to impinge on these questions like, can machines think, where there's a philosophical and a language component in addition to not having the kind of the training and the vocabulary and the recognition of the danger that lies in ambiguous use of language. In addition, I mean, let me choose my words carefully here, but I would say there's also a little bit of a lack of humility in, you know, in some of the STEM communities toward non-STEM work, right? That people will happily start talking about the God particle and a theory of everything without, and the last thing that will occur to them, and even if it does occur to them, they won't act on it, is looking, do non-STEM disciplines have anything to offer here? People will happily start pondering the question, is GPT-4 thinking? Is it exhibiting understanding? And they will happily ignore, you know, anything that non-machine learning communities have thought about these questions, or any of the difficulties and dangers of kind of, you know, starting down that on a question like that, without some appreciation of the dangers and ambiguities in kind of in language.
Yes, indeed. I see your point there on the larger level. If I might to just close up here on a super micro level, down into the sentences of papers and so on, if somebody came from the humanities background, from language background, outside of STEM, and made the claim, hey, your important research here, you're actually making it harder than it needs to be. And if they had an answer as to how that might get easier, I'm thinking of things like, shorter papers, clearer writing, straightforward statements, clear logical organization and so on. If somebody came with a fairly, swift method for applying such an approach, what would you say?
Yeah, I'm all in favor. I mean, a big disappointment to me in say the academic security community is the most prestigious conferences are all 12 pages and up for the paper. So there are some ideas where hey, I can write this in 2 pages, I can string it out to 3, there's no point in going any further. I'm a big fan of the kind of, explain things in simple language. A bunch of people have said it. George Orwell, of all people, has a very good, list of, I can't remember everything on the list, but never use a big word where a small one would do. If you can strike something out, if you can simplify a sentence by rearranging the clauses, do it. Any barrier, anything that gets in the way of someone understanding with the smallest possible amount of effort, because people are rushed, people don't have time, a lot of people don't share the same language as you. Anything that puts a barrier because of you didn't spend 5 years training in this particular subfield that I did, so you don't know the language and the gatekeeping words that keep you out, even though the concepts might be quite simple. Anything like that, anything more language more complicated than needs to be, I'm all in favor of pruning that out. I mean, make everything as accessible across technical communities, but also to lay people who are willing to put in a little bit of effort.
A closing question, Cormac, that I would like to give you, and it involves writing again, right on topic with what we're here, just extending it in a slightly different direction. I mean, when you look across a project, we've spent a lot of time in this interview talking about your SOC paper, your literature review there, which is, of course, perhaps a slightly unusual form. I mean, the daily bread of the researchers, of course, the normal conference paper or the research article, depending on the field. When you look at one of those projects, from start to finish, of course, there's going to be plenty of proofs. There's going to be plenty of experiments being run, code and so on. But where do you position the reading and the writing? I mean, if you could just imagine looking, from end to end across a project and you had to situate the reading and the writing in some sort of proportional fashion to what that project meant. Is there any way that you could describe the way it looks then to you?
I'm not sure I have a kind of a prescription or a process, which maybe means that I'm a little inefficient in how I do things and how I execute projects. But I think for very many projects, I sort of all through I have this kind of imaginary dialogue going on with, my imagined audience or a representative of my imagined audience, where I'm trying to convince, and the point of the dialogue is really for me to, well, what am I trying to convince them of? If I can't tell myself first what I'm trying to convince them of, then success is going to be a little unlikely or capricious. So I try to have that sort of, telling myself, you're not going to be able to make it clear for someone else until you are yourself, amazingly clear on what it is you're trying to communicate and amazingly certain about what you're trying to communicate, right? You can't be, you can't clearly communicate something where you're not yourself fairly certain of your facts on the matter. So I think it's that sort of imaginary dialogue for me is, even if I don't start writing until a lot of the technical work has been done, the imaginary dialogue is kind of a part of the shape of the paper, right? It sort of is, okay, I think the following is the case, and I spend a bunch of time, or we spend a bunch of time gathering all of our evidence. But then the paper is really, okay, I want to convince my audience that this thing is the case, and here's how I structured, here's why you might not think it's the case, here's why you might object to the particular experiments we've done. You have that sort of that imaginary dialogue that I've been running all the time is kind of, you know, my draft outline.
Yeah, I mean, this, I have to follow up with one comment there, because it's really interesting what you say there about the moment at which this dialogue becomes so intensive that it demands recording in the actual writing, let's say. But you're suggesting that it's actually going on in some form or other anyway, while you're running the experiments, while you're doing whatever other technical aspects to the project that need to be done as well. So, I mean, it's integral, isn't it? This
yeah,
thinking.
No. Yeah. Absolutely, and you know, the experiments, right? I mean, experiments are always sort of, I think, you know, there's a quote which I think we used from Darwin. Well, in experiments, are you're always doing an experiment to argue for or against, you know, some particular point of view. You're trying to rule out, you know, one explanation or draw attention to something that has been ignored. That the structure of which experiments we do and why we did them and the order in which we did them is itself part of that dialogue of, hey, we're trying to investigate. We think that the following thing is the case, and here's the journey, here's the dialogue. And okay, often when you get close to the end, you realize that, well, I don't need to take the reader on this long winding road. There were some dead ends that we explored that where you don't have to drag the reader through all of that. But a lot of the work is part of the dialogue, right? It's here's why we did. We were trying to create a convincing case that, you know, X is the case. The experiments are that trajectory. That internal dialogue is describing that trajectory, and the paper is mapping that in the simplest language I can to get someone there with the least jargon, the least the least expectation of effort on their part, and the simplest language.
Yeah, and I mean, this raises the question of, yeah, what goes in and what goes out as well, as you're saying. I mean, there were dead ends, there were exploratory work and so on. I think it's also an interesting point as far as writing process is concerned. It's certainly something that I get often asked is, what is the sort of writing to be doing before results are in? You know, before you know what it is that the dialogue is really about, let's say. I often advise people there to, you know, if you're doing exploratory research, then do some exploratory writing about it as well. But, I mean, people have very different feelings about this matter.
I mean, I think a good place to start is, we started investigating the following question, like, well, why did you find that question interesting? And why is the answer not glaringly obvious? And why is it important, right? Those are all things that are sort of at the beginning. They're the origin story of this research that you're doing. But they're capturing that, hey, here's why we think, here's why we're puzzled about whether X is true or X is not true. Here's why we think it's interesting. That's capturing the spark at the start of the project. You know, there was a reason that you there was a reason that you embarked on this journey. I don't want the answer to that question, why did you embark on that journey? Well, because I wanted to write a paper. No, that's not a good answer. It's like, here's something that looked like a paradox to me. Here's something where it looked like this observation contradicted that theory. Is it really a contradiction, or and if so, how could we? There's a problem that I'm trying to solve, not just a paper that I'm trying to write. And describe why you found that problem interesting. I think, you know, that gets you off to a great start.
And would you say that this is also something that you practice to? I mean, talk about dialogue, which I find is a fascinating metaphor. I mean, it's actually not even a metaphor. I can hear you already, Cormac.
No. I really have this imaginary voice in my head.
but do you find yourself then utilizing a sort of note taking or jotting or journal keeping that keeps the project alive? You know, sort of wind puts a bit of oxygen into the spark, gets you know, sets the course right, and so on.
Yeah, I do. I keep a physical notebook where I handwrite stuff in. I also, you know, send emails to myself on kind of notes on things. I mean, I do find, yeah, keeping a notebook, you know, it's definitely, you know, helps remembering things. It's also good where you go back and like, oh, something that seems glaringly obvious to me today, when you go back and look what I was writing in my notebook about this 3 months ago, it wasn't glaringly obvious. So that can be a useful exercise that, oh, something that seems too obvious to even bother explaining to the reader is, well, it wasn't obvious to me 3 months ago. So maybe it is. And it's also, I do find the notebook is, you know, purely on a, you know, keep you going thing. It's like, you know, if you put a page or two in the notebook, you feel you got something done with the day, even if, you know, even if what you just wrote is superseded by, you know, the work you do a week or two from now. It gives you some, you know, sense of moving forward.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, text is being produced, right? I suppose, though, what is it that tells you, okay, so I'm thinking about this hard problem, I'm motivated to figure out the answer, I understand why it's a problem, and it's not just a paper I want to write. What is, though, the moment there, though, that you realize, aha, this is paper material now? So let's say the gears shift, and you might not be at the writing stage. Of course, when you're at the writing stage, really producing the PDFs and stuff like that, that you already know you have a paper a long time ago. But I'm talking about that switch moment when you ramp up the design of your studies. You know, you really start digging into the literature to see if there's something on that before you. You know what I mean? The entire process gets going. What is the? Is there a way to put your finger on that?
I don't know. I haven't really. For me, yeah, maybe that's one of the points where it becomes a little bit more work and a little less fun, because there is some point where, yeah, you've gotten to, you know, clarity on the question that you want, and I do, you know, I often, you know, write things, you know, as a draft, just so it's easy to keep the fuzzy thoughts in your head and think you have it clear, and I could write it down clearly if I needed to. And then when you actually try to write it down, it's not as clear as you thought. So I often do that even when I'm not aiming at a particular publication yet. But when you start thinking, oh, okay, let's aim for this conference, you know, and the deadline is June or whatever, then some of it becomes a little more of a grind where you have to sort of think what reviewers are going to want. What's the easiest criterion to reject this paper that a reviewer is going to? You have to, that act of writing defensively and that's where it gets a little bit, you know, it's a little less fun.
That's a great way of putting it. And also this defensive writing. I like that. This is something that I've actually broached with one other researcher before. I mean, what is your posture as an author? You know, is it because, you know, so many principal researchers, principal investigators are also reviewers, so they can don that cap quite well. And they're like, okay, so if I'm actually writing for one of me, you know, what's the best way to couch this into the best terms so that it gets through? And I wonder if, I mean, I was playing sort of devil's advocate, say, well, what if you cooperated instead? What would that look like? You know, I mean, how do you get it so that the writing is telling the other person, you know, you're contributing to this as well, right? I'm implying this, understand that, and yep. we'll synthesize it later.
And I think some journals and some conferences are trying to get a bit more interaction between reviewers and authors, and you know, make it a little more interactive and allow feedback from reviewers to not just be rejected, you know, go somewhere else, try again, but you know, well, you know, here's how you would downsize your claims or upsize your experiments to convince us and get in. But that's encouraging, but I think it's a little bit nascent yet. I don't think we're quite there.
Well, thank you very much for that, Cormac. That is Cormac Hurley, Principal Researcher at Microsoft Research. I'm Daniel Shea, and this is goodbye from me to Cormac. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Thank you so much.
And this is goodbye to all of you. Bye-bye, and until next time here on Scholarly Communication.